Estos son los Freedom Fiends, transmitiendo desde Podbeidosa, a un kilómetro de altura sobre el nivel del mar, en los estudios intergalácticos de la pradera. Alteramos tu locus cerúleo, calentando tu sinapsis con rejuvenecedoras ondas de radio. Esto calienta tu cerebro a unos sabrosos y tostaditos 365 grados, manteniendo la avalancha de estatismo fuera de tu cabeza. So, ¿lo sientes? Can you feel it?
I can feel it.
And who's there?
This is the jabbering coon cat, Chandler St. Pierre.
And this is the jet cockatoo, Hugo Gonzalez, Hugo from Mexico. And this is your favorite show, The Freedom Fiends.
Naturally. So how's the weather down there in Mexico?
It is reasonably warm. Usually we have colder Octobers and Septembers, and then it goes, I don't know, there's usually cold air coming from the North Pole these days, but it's okay. I don't know, probably 20.
So what's a colder October down there?
Colder October is probably 15 Celsius. So let me just do a quick conversion here. Probably if we had our fiends from other countries with the metric system, that they would know, but I don't. So it is. Oh my God, I can do this. Okay, that's 59.
Wow, that is kind of chilly for the south.
I mean,
it's today we hit a high of 64, and that's warm for October. It's been getting really cold. It got down to like 30 the other night. I've been out cutting wood and getting ready for the winter. It's, you know, fall's my favorite time of year scenery wise, but knowing that you got to get ready for the cold, not so much.
You know what? I was seeing, this was an image or a meme on these days that people usually, when they felt exactly at the same temperature where they were going into fall or into winter, they would be already wearing scarves and heavy clothing, and when that same temperature was getting out of winter, they would be wearing shorts. Is that a thing?
I think for some people, like,
people get all excited.
Mom, well, my poor mom's up here. She's been up for the summer, and she lives in Florida. And the last week, man, she's been freezing. She's like, fire up that wood stove, you know, get that heater going. but, you know, if I were to go down, like, the first year I went to live with her when I was a teenager, I was down there in December, and I was swimming in the ocean. People stared at me like I was crazy or something. So, man, this is warm.
Well, one thing that's good about tropical climates is that the water in the ocean is kind of warm, even though it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in the Gulf of Mexico. Pacific is always chilly.
Well, I've decided that... and I've actually researched this a little bit, too. If I win, like, you know, the lottery or Powerball or Megabucks or whatever it is, I'm going to buy an island, preferably one in the Southern Hemisphere, and just sit on the beach and, you know, do the Freedom Fiends and sip beer.
You have to pull an internet link, probably, because, you know.
Well, yeah, I haven't worked that little snag out yet. But other than that, it'll be great, you know, just reading, writing, you know, listening to music, you know, eating coconuts and sipping beer. Can't wait.
Yeah, and would that all be by yourself?
No, anyone who's cool is welcome to join me. Mm. You know, there's actually an island off the coast of Maine for sale. I think somebody on my Facebook posted it. It might have been Donna, our Derek, our computer programmer, his wife. I think she had posted it on my Facebook. But I don't want an island off the coast of Maine. I already live in Maine. It's cold up here.
Yeah, yeah.
I want a tropical island.
I've looked some of those tropical islands up, and then I found one near the coast of Panama, and that's tiny, very, very, very green, and, you know, jungle, full of jungle parts island, and I like that one. And you know, the problem with those islands for sale is they don't give you the whole rights. You should be able to do whatever you want, but you won't be able. You'll be able to buy a plot of land that's, you know, by coincidence, it's an island, but you won't get sovereignty, which is something I would love to have.
Yeah, there's it's not impossible, but it's darn near impossible to actually get what they call a Lodium title to property nowadays.
What would that be?
That is, I don't know. It's very convoluted, but it's actually a principle in, I think it's international law, and you know, back in the colonial days, and I think right up until, I think it was till the Civil War, if you homesteaded land, and we're talking on the North American continent, but I think it applied everywhere. When you homesteaded land, you got what was called a Lodium title. That means you owned, you know, the land, you know, underneath, the dirt, the air, you know, you actually own the property. You didn't have to register it. You didn't have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah,
that sort of thing. And now you can't do that.
You wouldn't be subject to zoning either, right?
Exactly.
Mm.
Well, there wasn't even zoning back then, but yeah. So yeah, that's what we need to get back to, true ownership.
Yeah, that would be the holy grail for us, right? You know, I looked into another island in the Pacific that's called Niue. I don't know if that's a way to pronounce it, but it's you know, those islands in the South Pacific, which are rather hard, which have rather harsh climate, and they have harsh winters. And Niue is one of those, but it now belongs to New Zealand, and there's probably 300 people living there. They're all subsidized because, you know, nobody wants to be there, and yet New Zealand wants to have some people living there to claim the island. And, you know, you could just go there and do some liberty outreach and maybe, you know, declare secession.
Yeah, secession down to the last man. I actually read a story about a guy, I think it was in Alaska. And, you know, that myth that government can own land, right? You know, in the U.S., I believe it's under the Bureau of Land Management or some nonsense like that.
Yeah, and some other countries, it's even in the Constitution.
Yeah, so it was like some government, you know, supposedly government-owned land up in Alaska. And this guy just homesteaded it, built a cabin, and, you know, had a garden and a greenhouse, and he was really self-sufficient, doing really well for himself. And he left up all the no trespassing signs, you know, like, this is government land, you can't enter without permission or whatever. He left them up to, like, deter people from checking out what he had done. And he was actually successful for the longest time. I think he had lived there a few years. I'm not sure the exact amount, but he had lived there for a while. You know, wasn't paying taxes or anything because nobody even knew he was there. And then somebody reported him, and, you know, the government came and said, you can't do this. And he said, well, I just did. And I think eventually they moved him off the land. But hey, good for him for trying at least, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if, you know, you really have to be enthusiastic about that to, you know, run those risks, to take those risks, right?
Yeah, you do.
Because they could...
But, I mean, he made something out of that. You know, that land was just sitting there, probably overgrown, not well maintained, you know, chances for forest fires and stuff like that. And he cleared out a plot of land and actually made it purposeful and useful. You know, he was growing crops on it, he was living on it, and he did something with it. So I applaud him for that.
That's, yeah, and that's the original way of acquiring property, right? Something that didn't belong to anyone. You could just go in and plant something, do something with the land, I don't know, build a house, and then it was understood to be your own.
Yeah. Well, you can still do that. You just, like you said, you'll run the risk of, you know, crossing the government and having them send their goons to tell you you can't do something. But, you know, who knows? Maybe if more people did stuff like that, the government would have no choice but to just let it be.
Yeah, just, but, you know, people gotta have those internet links, uplinks, and fast internet to do radio shows over the air, so... Not many people do.
Well, you can, you know, I mean, you can do like one of our fiend hosts, James Babb, when he was visiting up in Maine. He was way up north by the border of Canada, and there's not much up there. I've been up there a couple of times, and You know, he just went to the local public library and sat there with his laptop so he could do the show. I mean, you can make do. It would be tough to, I'll admit, especially for me, it would be tough to live in the woods with no internet. But, you know, there are times where, you know, I just want to get away from it all. And I'm like, whew, I could do that. I'd probably last a week, but hey.
Yeah, you could probably do podcasting. You know, if you have a satellite link, you can send audio files. You cannot talk over the internet like we're doing right now with a great program, ThemePhone, for high quality audio. But you could always record and publish something there, even an hour of audio or something. You could do something, but you can do everything that we need.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I think you'd be happier too.
Yeah, you
know, there's something to be said about not being caught in the hustle and bustle of everyday life. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what that's like because I live in a 20 million people city. But yeah.
That's amazing.
Sometimes this looks like India, man. Like, if I'm downtown, there's just people everywhere. You can see on the sidewalks. You can see the sidewalk because it's just full of people, and you know, having those large cars they have in the U.S. that's just not possible in a city like this. I barely use my car on weekdays.
See, that's so weird. I mean, like, up until this week, I commuted a half an hour to another town every day to work, and there would just be no way of walking. You know, I mean, Maine is so sparsely populated that you need those cars and big trucks. But, you know, it kind of reminded me of a quote from Charles Bukowski, and it's from his book Factorum. And he says, how in the hell could a man enjoy being awakened at 8:30 a.m. by an alarm clock, leap out of bed, dress, force feed, go to the bathroom, brush his teeth and hair, and fight traffic to get to a place where essentially you made lots of money for somebody else and were asked to be grateful for the opportunity to do so?
There's people making money in the market. Let's let them.
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Fiends, and we're back from the market where people get up to an alarm clock and go to work for somebody else and make money. But that's all right.
Yeah, unfortunately, I do. But
I do too. It's not that bad.
I suppose it depends on your job. As long as you don't work for a psychopath, which is one of the things we're going to talk about today, actually.
Sure. Yeah. Have you ever met a psychopath? I don't know. I know we're not psychologists or psychiatrists, but you can tell, right?
You can. I've worked in the mental health field for off and on for 18 years. And yeah, I have come across a few. It's such a weird distinction between a psychopath and a sociopath. I mean, generally speaking, your psychopaths are your serial killers. They all psychopaths have the same traits as sociopaths, but not all sociopaths are psychopaths. Mm-hmm. Now, basically, the only true difference, there's a lot of subtle differences, but the main one is that psychopaths tend to be more violent and act on those violent impulses, whereas sociopaths are more subtle and not always as violent. I mean, there are exceptions, of course. A classic example of a sociopath would be, politicians. Most of the politicians in office around the world are sociopaths because they have this grandiose idea of themselves, and they're uncaring, and they have no empathy.
Yeah, you know, that's something I wanted to ask you, because I know you've worked in the mental health field, and I usually didn't make a difference, didn't make at all a difference between psychopaths and sociopaths. And I think that's a common confusion. People confuse it too. And there's a term that's an antisocial disorder. What's the name for that?
Antisocial behavioral disorder.
Yeah.
That's a new designation. That's, I think that came out in the DSM-5. The DSM is the,
the Lund manual.
Yeah, it's basically the manual.
Yeah. Yeah,
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and we are now at the 5th edition. And I actually have read the 4th edition. I don't put a lot of stock in it, especially the 5th edition, because a lot of traits that individualists, liberty-minded people in particular, display are now considered personality disorders.
That the famous ODD, right?
Yeah. Oppositional defiance disorder. It's very reminiscent of what Stalin did in the Soviet Union, right? And he was a true definition of a psychopath.
Sure.
He takes the cake, I think, in the 20th century. I mean, he killed over 20 million people. He was, had this grandiose ideal of himself. He was extremely paranoid. He was extremely violent. He was uncaring.
Yeah,
had no empathy.
Wasn't that phrase attributed to Stalin? The death of a million is just statistics.
Yeah,
yeah. So that would be a good motto for a psychopath.
Yeah. Line. I don't know if you listen to Marilyn Manson at all.
I have, but...
yeah, I'm a pretty big fan. But they have this one song called The Fight Song. And in it, and this was written around the time of Columbine, and the line goes, "The death of one is a tragedy, but the death of millions is just a sight to see." And that's a play off that quote by Stalin. But, what he did to crush opposition in the Soviet Union, political opposition, was he basically said that anyone that was against the ideas of communism and the Soviet style republic were crazy, and they had a mental disorder. And they wrote up a few, I don't remember the exact ones, but their psychiatrist, who most of the time were forced at gunpoint, their psychiatrists and academics were forced at gunpoint to make these determinations and these definitions. And yeah, so you were crazy if you opposed the state, and you were a danger, so they could lock you up, and they were actually doing society a favor because you were a danger, right?
But you don't have to give crazy people due process. That would be one of the tricks with that technique. Yep. for silencing opposition or dissenters.
And you see it today in this country.
Yeah.
So it's a dangerous path to go down. And we're going to go down the path to the market right now. But when we get back, we'll talk more about psychopaths.
That's
worms.
Worms.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Market.
Market worms.
market worms. Meow, 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 meow. And we're back. Freedom Fiends. Hugo from Mexico, that's me. And Chandler, who is up in Maine, right?
Right on.
Okay. And we were talking about psychopathy and sociopaths, psychopaths, antisocial disorder? What was the name of that?
Antisocial behavioral disorder, I think. I don't know.
That's a new name for it. Yeah. And politicians who can profit from being psychopaths, as opposed to probably the general population. You know, you gotta do quid pro quo with your fellow man, and there's some select environments in which psychopaths can thrive, right?
Oh yeah, politics. Ooh. and mega corporations are too.
Sure.
And you know, it's interesting because we make the distinction between psychopathy and sociopathy because of the violent tendencies and, you know, committing murder and brutal atrocities. And we tend to attribute sociopathy more to the political side. But think about it. I mean, what was it, just last week or earlier this week? I'm not sure which, but you know, the United States military bombed a hospital in Kabul, and it was one of the, you know, the ones with Doctors Without Borders, and, you know, murdered a bunch of innocent people. And that's happened time and time again. And Obama, or whoever the puppet is in the Oval Office, gives the order for that. And that's a pretty violent act.
Yeah, that's killing people. You're only not getting, you know, blood stains on your clothes, but you're killing you're killing people. And any regular, normal, I'm going to use the term normal here, or neurotics in terms of psychoanalysis, you know, regular normal people wouldn't get, would lose a lot of sleep if they knew they caused the death of, I don't know, tens of people, even just the one people. If you if a regular person runs over someone else with a car and kills them, you know, they would need counseling for probably months.
Oh yeah, there'd definitely be some trauma there. But apparently, it doesn't bother these psychopaths and these sociopaths that run the state.
And I think it probably was a psychopath or a sociopath who invented the passive voice. You know, a hospital was bombed, people were killed, and that's really, really convenient if you don't have to tell your fellow man you're a psychopath and you don't really care. What's the deal with empathy in psychopaths? I understand a psychopath does not feel empathy. They don't feel bad when bad things happen to other people. Would that be a correct definition or a useful definition?
Yeah, it is. That is correct. And I think part of that stems from the fact that people with psychopathic tendencies have such a grand idea of the self, and they're self-centered. Now, when I was reading the textbook definitions of psychopathy, it's very broad, right? You have to really get into it to understand it. But the broad definitions can apply to a lot of people because, hey, there's a lot of people that are selfish at times, you know?
Yeah, we're all selfish at some point, right?
Yeah, and sometimes there are times when an individual may lack empathy. But that doesn't make you a psychopath. I guess it really depends on, you know, there may be a situation that will arise that you would display some of these traits, but it's not until it becomes a consistent it's in your personality consistently that's when you got to worry about it.
And in evolution of biology, you know, you always have to ask why is a trait in that species. You know, if you are a giraffe and you have a long neck, you can wonder why you have a long neck, and then you find out about the treetops and that you can survive with that. And probably if you're in a war between two tribes or some extreme situation, you probably will do well if you're a psychopath. You know, you can slay all those people and not feel anything and protect your offspring and your family and maybe your people really close to you. That would be useful in some cases, and probably that's why it stayed with us.
Yeah. There is a big argument with genetics versus or upbringing, right? Environment,
nature or nurture.
And, yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I used to think that. I guess I still do, but I used to think upbringing had more to do with it. But there's a side of it, right, that ties into genetics. I mean, if you have a genetic predisposition to be violent, then you really have to govern your life so that you don't expose yourself to those triggers. Now, when people talk about their upbringing made them crazy or made them a psychopath, there's the psychological aspect to that that's true, but you got to figure when a child grows up and they suffer continuous trauma, whether it's physical abuse, verbal abuse, abandonment, stuff like that, that not only has a psychological effect on the child, but it also has a physiological effect on how the child's brain develops.
Yeah, it's different.
So if you have those genetic predispositions, you're just increasing it.
Yeah, it's different if you get it later on in your life when your brain's fully developed, right? And
yes,
I've heard this phrase said about psychopaths, where other people have an empathy system or an empathy organ, they just have a hole. And it's just not developed. They didn't build those structures where they can. Or they didn't need them. You know, if you're being beat up every day by some parent or abused by siblings or other people, why should you develop the ability to know when those people are suffering? Actually, it's worse for you. It won't help you with defense against them.
No, it doesn't. And you know, there's also the argument that injuries, specifically traumatic brain injury, can induce psychopathy. There's an example. They don't make the direct correlation, but I think it fits the bill. Earl Nelson, he was called the Gorilla Killer, and he was born in May 12th, 1897, and he died January 13th, 1928. But when he was 10... he got into an accident, right? Got hit by a car, and he was in a coma for 6 days. And after he awoke, his behavior started becoming erratic, and it just progressed through his teenage years and his early adult years. He only lived to be, I think, 28.
Was he one of those famous psychopathic killers?
Yeah, he was. He killed, what is he responsible for? He murdered more than 20 people.
Well, that's still less than a general out there and some bombing some hospital. But we you know, there's no propaganda with those people, and we can see them as monsters.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I think people like that, like you know, Ed Earl Nelson or Ed Gein or Charles Manson, you know, those people are horrible, horrible human beings. But I think that the nation state leader that orders military strikes that result in the death of millions of people is far more horrible. You know, you can take it on a philosophical level and argue it if you want, but I mean, they're not even getting their hands dirty. They're with a strike of a pen or a fiat order, and they're
just give the order.
Millions.
Yeah, just give the order, and sometimes, you know, just take full responsibility for the order, whatever that means at those levels. You know, I did
but they
order.
Don't.
Yeah, but, well, they don't. But at some point, when they're lying in bed at night, they have to face their own decisions. And probably, if you're a psychopath, it's just, you know, something you did on the day that day, like anything else.
Well, do you think, though, honestly, you look at George Bush Sr., the elder, do you think he loses any sleep over the atrocities that were a result of his presidency?
I don't think he does, and probably that's why I think he's probably a psychopath. I don't know about George Bush the junior.
I think that that boy was just an unfortunate puppet.
Yeah.
I don't think he realized what his daddy and all their friends were getting him into.
You know,
he strikes me as a typical sociopath, but he's not very smart. That's the one thing. Sociopaths and psychopaths are generally very intelligent, and they're very manipulative. You look at the speeches that Hitler and Mussolini gave Germany and Italy prior to World War II, and the masses rallied towards them. They were charismatic. They were manipulative. They knew exactly what to say. Granted, they were playing on nationalistic fears, but people around them just adored them.
Yeah, and you know, they have this capability of lying, and they know exactly what to say. And we all probably, if we paid attention, we would know what to say, but we wouldn't dare say it. That's the difference. We would feel, we would know we were lying, and we would probably have some kind of restraint, but they don't. So they know they can. I don't know. Let's talk about Hitler. He knows people are scared of, Poland and losing their homeland, whatever kind of discourse he used. And he knows, and he knows that that's probably not true, but he knows it by, he can get his way by lying to the people, by moving those feelings in the populace. So he just went ahead and said it. And that's a special kind of intelligence where you can feel not empathy, but you can have sympathy and know what will motivate other people and what will, you know, make them feel. And you can pretty much mimic real feelings or deep feelings.
Yes, that's another excellent point. That's another classic example is sociopaths and psychopaths are mimics. They have no shame or no remorse, but they can mimic that. And they can mimic that empathy based on what they observe for other people.
Yeah, they have classic. Learned that if you talk about something bad that happened to a family member, you should be saying, I'm really sorry, and putting up the face
exactly.
of being sorry.
It's learned behavior. And think about when you listen to speeches of politicians, how much of that is scripted and learned speech, and there's no empathy in it whatsoever.
Have a speech writers.
Yeah.
Be back.
Worms.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Yeah.
Wow.
Worms without empathy. Freedom Fiends, back again, Chandler and me, Hugo. So Chandler, we were talking about psychopaths. We're still
talking about
I read, there's this book called Political Ponderology, and it's written by a Polish psychologist who lived in Poland during the Cold War, behind the Iron Curtain. And it's practically a denunciation of psychopathy. And he says, what he says is, people, we realized, we psychologists in Poland, realized that we were being ruled by psychopaths, which is a pretty strong statement to make. And actually, they were defunded after they published some of their findings. And they get conspiranoic about those things, and they said, you know, probably the higher ups knew that we were learning of how they worked. And he says, you know, pathocracy, which is the name he gave it, people start working or acting like psychopaths because it works. It works, and they see their higher-ups are, or their leaders are being successful with that. And people,
so they have a better chance for advancement if they act like that.
Yeah, so people in general are start to act like psychopaths, and they, you know, all the remorse they try to put down or hide, and they have to give this impression that they too are psychopaths. I've thought about countries that were very socialistic in the past, like Mexico, and sometimes people work even in the private industry, they think like bureaucrats, and I think that's something to do with it.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think that goes to show that humanity has a long way to go if we need to, as a society, mimic those unhealthy behaviors to advance. I mean, we should be striving to promote behaviors that are healthy, cooperating, you know, individually, cooperating together voluntarily to accomplish common goals and innovate, rather than mimicking the bureaucracy, like you said.
Yeah, totally. And I think actually psychopaths, the environment will either help a psychopath thrive as a psychopath, or maybe help him or her behave like a normal person. And I think that's the difference, for example, between government and the free market, where, you know, in government, though, that which is the most ruthless will rise in the ranks of government.
You see that in the monopolistic mega corporations that are, you know, basically enabled by government law, and the people that thrive in that tend to exhibit those sociopathic and psychopathic tendencies.
And I think they don't, you know, being a psychopath is no excuse. And I'll explain a bit of what I'm trying to say. We as libertarians, liberty-minded people, we tend to recognize that the non-aggression principle is true and is valid for everybody else. Somebody will tell you, okay, what if you don't feel any empathy? What if you don't feel, what if you steal from somebody else and yet you feel nothing? And I would say, well, you don't have to feel it. It is intellectually true that in order to have just the one rule for everybody, you have to use the non-aggression principle, even if you don't feel anything.
Right. Well, a psychopath or a sociopath couldn't use the non-aggression principle. They would just claim it's only a crime if you get caught, right? Mm. There's no remorse. There's no sense of guilt there for theft or aggression. So I think that's what separates, good, decent, anarchistic folks from those crazy psychopaths and sociopaths.
Yeah, but we still have to live with probably 5% of the population, right?
Yeah, they say, I've heard estimates anywhere from 1 to 5%. I think 5% is probably more accurate.
Yeah, so
I think psychopaths are about 1%, sociopaths are 5, maybe 8, 10%, and then, you know, the rest are just good, honest people trying to get by and survive.
Whoa.
So, you know, one famous psychopath is Joseph Mengele, the Angel of Death, and that's also a song by the band Slayer, which we're going to talk about in the next hour of the Freedom Beat.
Yeah, let's do that.
So, stay tuned, everyone.
Worms.
Are you tired of governments murdering people around the world? Stop using their money. There is an alternative. Bitcoin is a stateless free market non-political currency. Bitcoin cannot be inflated or controlled by any government. By using their money, you are helping the state. Stop doing it. You have an incredible alternative available now. Learn it, use it, spread it. Get started with Bitcoin at bitcoin.com. That's bitcoin.com.
Trigger warning, this is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting live from the back alleys of Babylon, We babysit the binary blip inside your brain with a combination of badinage and technical tabulations, helping to sacralize your senses to the salacious songs of liberty. Can you feel it, Hugo? Can you feel it?
See, sure I can feel it. It's coming in through my ear hole. And probably through the ear hole of everybody else listening, the second hour of The Fiends.
We're infecting their ear holes with truth. And we should remind everyone that The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT, no government license, which allows use by everyone except who?
Governments. Except those, governments. Well, probably as many psychopaths there as we were talking in the last hour.
Yes. Yeah. And you can learn more at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. So, yeah, we were talking about psychopathy last hour. Sociopathy, psychopathy. And it got me to thinking about a song by this most excellent band called Slayer. And they have a song called Psychopathy in Red. It was off their last album, World Painted Blood. And they also have a song about a famous they actually have a couple of songs about famous psychopaths, and they're not praising them or embracing them. They're just illustrating the horror of these individuals. They have a song called Angel of Death, which is about Joseph Mengele, the Nazi physician, I guess you could call him. And they also have a song called Dead Skin Mask, which is about Ed Gein, the serial killer. So, yeah.
So why would they... you were just saying they weren't celebrating, but what's the deal with talking about psychopaths and killers?
Well, you know, Slayer is... I don't know if they're a unique metal band. They happen to be my favorite metal band. They're next to Soulfly. I really like Soulfly, too. They have a lot of songs where they illustrate the horror and the absurdity of war, for instance. That's a good one. I mean, you go back a ways, Mandatory Suicide, War Ensemble. What's the other one? There's another. Expendable Youth. These are all songs about the horrors of war and how these men in high places, you know, play their games on the world stage and send these young men and women out to die for them. You know, with Angel of Death, they recall the horrors of Auschwitz and the Nazi concentration camps and what Mengele did. Same with Dead Skin Mask, you know, what Ed Gein did to his victims. And I think that metal serves a purpose. I think it has a couple of different purposes. Metal to me, I've always loved heavy metal, and I have quite a eclectic music taste. You know, I listen to everything, classical, outlaw country, movie scores, even some hip-hop, industrial, you name it. But I've always, metal's been in my blood, you know. And to me, metal, heavy metal music is just has this ingrained sense of individualism, you know, people that stand out from the crowd. They feel like outcasts or outsiders, you know. And it's all about rebellion and
originality.
Resisting. Yeah, originality, yeah. You know. Resisting what society tells you is the norm. But it also serves to illustrate some of the horrors that we see in the world. You know, I think the folk music scene and some of the early rock scene of the mid to late 60s, they kind of went on the anti-war bent, which was cool, and they talked about the absurdities of war, but that was about it. They didn't really push the limits. And then, you know, music went to a totally different direction, and for the most part, music ignored a lot of the societal ills. But then with the emergence of heavy metal, I think a lot of heavy metal artists reintroduced these ideas, you know, that the world is not always this wonderful, happy-go-lucky place. And they illustrated some of these horrors in this music. And what it did was it served people to face reality of the horrible atrocities that were going on.
You know, I'm not a great metal fan, but one of the things that stands out is that heavy metal's has never been really mainstream. There's mainstream bands, but metal has never been a music that everybody likes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at Slayer, right? Again, just one of the most amazing bands out there. They've been around since 1983, and I could probably count on one hand the list of friends that I have that actually could sing a whole Slayer song, you know. and there's a lot of others, you know. But heavy metal went kind of down a weird route too. You had the hair bands and the goth metal and the black metal and the there's so many subgenres.
There's so many flavors of metal, speed metal and, you know,
death metal.
You can make jokes and come up with liberty metal and new genres.
Well, there was a band, Iced Earth, and John Schaefer was the lead guitarist. He formed Iced Earth, and then he later formed a band called Sons of Liberty. And I got to speak with John. He's a cool guy. And, you know, his whole thing was he was really into the liberty thing, you know, freedom and individualism. At the time, he was kind of taking it from a minarchist perspective, but he evolved like the rest of us. But he really set the second Sons of Liberty album was far more anarchistic than the first, but they're both good albums, you know. But metal music is such a, I don't know, it for me, like, I've spent most of today listening to Slayer and, what was the other one I was listening to? Jeez, I can't even remember because most of it was Slayer. I don't know, probably some Soulfly or something. But I got to tell you, the feelings and the emotions that metal invoke in me and many people I've seen going to metal concerts, you know. In fact, I have a great show pick. I'll have to send it to Michael before he uploads it to the servers. There's a picture of me. I may have been slightly intoxicated. I was at Ozfest, you know, giving the horns out in the field. Woo! Loving it, you know. And that's the thing. You know, I remember there's a sense of brotherhood among metalheads, too. The last metal show I went to was Black Label Society in Portland, Maine. And I'm getting a little older now. I'm not as young as I used to be, you know. I still go in the pits, but I tend to fall down a little more than I used to.
Yeah, you should watch your hips there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's kind of what I was thinking, you know. So the last show I went to, I must have got knocked down about 5 times. But I'll tell you, man, the minute my butt hit the ground, somebody was already grabbing a hold of me and pulling me right back up. You know, and it's that kind of camaraderie and kind of brotherhood that I really, really love. Like, I mean, I've never been to, I don't know, who's like a popular musician now? Like Lady Gaga, I guess, or Britney Spears or something. I don't know. But I can imagine if you fell down at a concert like that, no one would probably pay attention to you, you know?
Yeah. Everyone's out for themselves and for the artist itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, growing up in the pits, I can remember, well, my first concert was the Grateful Dead, so that was a little bit different. There wasn't any mosh pits at the Dead, although I almost got trampled by a bunch of hippie chicks at that show. It was kind of strange. But yeah, man, so I think metal really embraces a lot of the ideals we speak about on The Fiends a lot, you know? And
the individualistic nature of, you know, truth.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes truth is uncomfortable, right? It's not pleasant, but you still got to face it. You got to confront it.
Still got to face it. You still got to say it, and you still got to, you know, tell other people about it. And I don't know. It's there's got to be something about the message or the spirit of metal that you can tell something is heavy metal, even if it sounds completely different. And there's got to be some of that spirit there, because, you know, you can there's death metal and there's this symphonic metal with lyrics about elves and fantasy things, and it's all of it. All of it's metal still, and the melodies are melodies are different. People, the singers sing a different way, and yet they feel all part of the same community in heavy metal. So that's got to be that. And another thing that stands out is how international heavy metal is.
Opposed
to something like, I don't know, probably country music or something different. Like the Grateful Dead are clearly American, and you know, you can see Finnish metal bands and Italian metal bands singing in English, which is amazing and surprising for me.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those Norwegian bands, man. I'm not into the whole black metal scene. Like, I think probably, and I know a lot of metalheads out there are going to laugh at me, but like the real like death metal, black metal bands that I like are Cradle of Filth, which I know they don't really count, but whatever, they're great. Yeah. And, you know, Death Clock from Metalocalypse, right? I have all the Death Clock albums. I love them. They're so great, you know? But, yeah, that whole international thing with metal, I don't know if you've experienced it, but a lot of the shows I used to watch online and download were big festivals that would take place in Europe and South America. And, you know, like the Big Four did a tour, and they went to a bunch of, they basically went to every continent. And the Big Four is Slayer, Anthrax. Oh, that's the other band I was listening to today, Anthrax.
A Basket Full of Puppies.
Yeah. So yeah, Slayer, Anthrax, Metallica, and Megadeth, and you know, the Big Four, and they went and just toured the world. They hit every concert, and some of these festivals in other countries. I mean, I've been, the biggest show I ever went to was the Grateful Dead, and that was about 100,000 people. And some of these festivals, like, you get 150,000 plus. It's amazing to see.
So to in metal, Freedom Fiends! Freedom fans, metal fans, Chandler and Hugo will be back after we go to the market.
Yeah.
Worms.
Metal worms. Leave it better than you found it.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. My fellow sheep. Election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Meow.
Leave it better than you found it.
Leave it better than you found it.
Death Clock. I want to hear Nathan Explosion say that.
Yeah, I can growl to save my life. Or Harsh, for that matter. And we're back. Talking about heavy metal, individualism, and camaraderie. And I think those things are not, you know, opposed at all.
No, not at all. I mean, I was talking before we left for the market about festivals. And, man, I'll tell you, down in South America and in Europe, you cats do the festivals on a huge scale. You know, like up here, we've got like, well, for years we had Ozfest, which, you know, was a decent metal festival. And I think they've got some other one now, Mayhem Festival or something. I haven't been to it. But, you know, you get like 25,000 people at those shows. But, man, those festivals down in South America and in Europe, you get 100 plus thousand people. It's an amazing thing to see.
Yeah,
very little violence too. You know, right?
Sure, sure. I hear that all the time with bands, even as early as the 70s, and when they come to Latin America, they say you people are very warm and engaging, and I guess that's true because I don't know. I've never given a concert in Latin America, but at any rate, I think that's true. People. Another thing is that not that many bands or big name bands are coming to Latin America the whole year. So there's the odd festival or the odd music fest where a lot of bands come in and people are really excited and really hyped up about the band. And they have large followings too. And there's I remember there's big name bands or great bands from Brazil and from Latin America in heavy metal. I remember one that I liked very much in the 90s. It's called Angra, and they were Brazilian. And I don't know if, well, Brujeria, they're Chicano, right? They're Mexican American, I think.
Yeah, one of my favorite bands, Soulfly, Max Cavalera, is Brazilian. They actually have a song, Brazil, and unfortunately I don't speak Spanish, but I still love that song, man. The drums in that. And that's the thing, like, especially with, even back in the days of Sepultura and with Soulfly, the drums, man, it's got that really jungle Latin American beat to that metal, and oh man, it just makes you want to get out there and thrash and dance. I love it. That's the other thing, like, I'm a fan of all different types of music, like I said earlier, but there's something about that metal, especially, you know, when you fuse in that South American beat to it, just makes me want to get out there and move, you know. Like, even driving in my car today, I was listening to Slayer, and I'm just like bobbing my head, and you know, I usually listen to music at like 10-15, and man, I had Slayer cranking at like 30 today.
You crank it all the way to up to 11.
Yeah, oh man. It just does something for me, I'm telling you. It makes me feel alive.
And you know, there's this story about Latin America that I would consider Jamaica to be Latin America, even if it's not Latin. I mean, it has the mix of African music and culture with European also culture there. And once I heard that when Jamaican people try to play rock and roll, they came up with reggae because you know it's so natural. And they were trying to play rock and roll. Maybe that's apocryphal, maybe that's not true, but that makes a lot of sense. Being from Venezuela, I remember there used to be rock bands in the 80s and 90s when I still lived back there. And I remember there were three or four bands that had some name. And now that I listen to them, going back there, they all sound like ska because, you know, it's what musicians are listening to all the time is Latin jazz and salsa and Cuban music and all these Latin rhythms. And whenever they want to play rock and roll or heavy metal, they bring some of that always into the music. And that's fun to listen to.
Oh yeah, that stuff's great. I mean, the drummer in me, and I'm a horrible drummer, but I do love to bang on the drums. And the drummer in me can really appreciate the Latin percussion. I mean, some of the stuff, like I remember back in band and even when I took private drum lessons, you know, my drum teacher, back then I was just into metal. You know, I was a teenager, so whatever. I didn't really have good taste or, you know, diverse taste, I should say. And my teacher was like, you know, you got to listen to some Latin music. You got to listen to some jazz, man. I'm telling you. So...
Yeah, and you know,
this has got a good beat right here, yeah, too, exactly, man. This is just hopping.
That's what I was thinking. Drumming for liberty. Meow, 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 meow. Worms.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Hey, there's some Squiskar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And UM's listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. By sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And Ask Me About My Worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1 1/4 inch, now they're 1 3/4 inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Fiends. Fiends. Freedom Fiends.
This is the Freedom Fiends. Freedom Fiends.
So yeah, we Freedom Fiends, we like music. And all the bumper music to the Freedom was actually done by Michael Dean. And I think it was his one man band, Right Arm of Wyoming.
That's cool true. Stuff. Yeah,
and it's amazing what you can do with computers nowadays. You know, like I am about as low level a musician as you can get. Like I have the basic concepts of music structure, and that's about it. And I play drums poorly, but I'll tell you, you know, I get in front of a computer and get going with the synths and the drums and all that stuff, and you can make some really cool. I've done a few songs, you know. I've done a lot of remixes and a few actual songs from scratch. And
even if you just,
it's pretty amazing.
Even if you just know the basics, you can always put loops together, right? And do a
yep.
nice bring a nice riff. And you, as long as you stay in tune with the actual tonality you're using, you can just do fine. And people yep. have, I don't know, there's this sort of snobism that people think that accessibility will, I don't know, ruins the whole experience. Like people would value scarcity in those things too. And I think that everybody being able to make music will obviously bring up some, you know, really low quality music, but it will also bring up some jewels that would have never seen the light of day.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the artist in me, you know, like I create art, I write a lot, and I used to do a lot of music, and it's not so much for I guess it is for public consumption, but it's more for myself, right? It's for myself first. I'm not looking to make a career out of it or gain a fan base or anything like that. If my art inspires you or, you know, provokes thoughts in you, that's cool. But that's not the intention I set out with. And I think a lot of genuine art out there, that's kind of where it starts, right? You know, the artist is trying to vocalize or interpret the myriad thoughts in their own mind and, you know, put it to paper or put it to music or whatever. And like you said, sometimes you can get some real jewels. I mean, I've written some real crap. I'll be the first to admit, you know.
You consider yourself in the first group? Technology enables
a lot. I've written a lot of real crap. But, you know, once in a while, I mean, there's a few things that I've written that I'm actually kind of proud of. You know, they, and a lot of people have said, hey, that's really trippy, really weird. I like that, you know, kind of got me wondering where you're coming from. But, yeah, I mean, and that's, I guess that's really gratifying that someone would even say that, you know. I don't think it's any has any less value if you're a professional artist. You know, you're going out to make art for the masses. I think that's really cool too, especially if you're really good at it. And so it could go either way.
Yeah, and probably even though you might think you don't have a lot to say, I think everybody has something to say because everybody is unique. And I just remember that being on conservative radio, we have to every hour we have to say. Well, we don't have to, but we like to say that Obama is a liar and a socialist and his feet stink. And I thought,
they sure do.
This would be a great idea for a song, but it's of course it's been done already.
I know.
Have you listened to it?
Nima got it already.
Yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah, it's by Nima Virati, the founding fiend. And the song's name is Obama's Feet Stink, right?
Yeah,
I think you can get
something
it on,
about Romney too.
Yeah,
like Romney likes it or something. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, you can get it on iTunes on iTunes probably. So yeah, you know the fiends doing music and there was I don't know if it was you before on some show with Michael, but on some fiends past fiend shows we were talking about. I wasn't there, but we fiends. We were talking about how music is really important for most of the fiends, and they've done, written, interpreted, played some instrument at some point. And you tell me you've what can you play? What do you like to do with music?
I'm really good at Rock Band, the video game. No, I like to play drums too. You know, I can keep a beat. I can't do anything overly complicated. My hands and my feet are in perfect sync, which, if you're a drummer, is
a total curse.
Total curse.
It's like trying to bounce a basketball as you're running. You know, if you're in sync, that's a bad thing.
Oh man, it's tough. But you know, I've always like when I was in middle school. You know, I think the first instrument I tried was trumpet. Then I went to trombone, and then once I got into fifth grade, I was able to do drums, and I was like, man, I really like this. And all I had was a little silent drum pad. I didn't even have a snare drum at the time. I actually saved up my paper route money and bought a used one at a pawn shop. And I used to go and stay after school. I was probably one of the only kids in middle school that would stay till like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the band room basement and just bang on the drums incessantly for hours, you know. I remember the first two songs I actually learned myself how to play just from like listening to it on my Walkman, dating myself a little, but listening on my Walkman and playing, I played Looks That Kill by Motley Crue and Ben Caught Stealing by Jane's Addiction. And I was super impressed. Like a couple of little errors, but for the most part, I was able to play the song. And then I just practiced that forever. And then when I got a drum teacher, I didn't get very many drum lessons. Most of my drum lessons were me just going to his house because he had a couple of drum sets in his basement, really nice ones. And I just go, you know, listen to Metallica or whatever and just bang on the drums for hours at a time. So, yeah, I mean, I did that for a while. And then once computers came about, you talked about looping. Yeah, I think my first program I got was Sonic Foundry's Acid Pro, and it's basically just a sound looping program. And I did a couple of songs on that, you know, just drum and synth loops and with a little bit of guitar. And then as I got into more, I started using Ableton Live and Reason, which I know Nima likes a lot. He uses that a lot.
Reason, yeah. I once downloaded and tried it, but I don't produce that much. I do podcasting and audio and voice, but I haven't done that much music. But I remember when I got my first sound card, I've always been into classical and vocal music, you know, choral music and I always liked that ever since I was in high school, all the way through college and then some, a bit more. And do you remember when there was those MIDI programs where you would compose scores and then play it through MIDI with a synthesis and you'd get this music that sounded like cell phone ringtones?
Yes, I do. I like those. I mean, it's amazing how far we've come. You know, like the last thing I got into, and it was the last song I composed, I did with Logic Pro on a Mac, which is an amazing piece of... Logic Pro is an amazing piece of software for music. One of my all-time favorite musicians, and any of you fiends out there already know who I'm going to say, but Trent Reznor and from Nine Inch Nails, he's a big Mac guy, and he does a lot of his stuff with Macs, but he also uses a lot of real hardware as well.
There used to be a time when only Macs could do it, right?
I think in the beginning, if you were doing graphic design and music, Macs were the way to go, but Windows kind of moved into that market slowly. I still think that your options are greater and there's a lot more efficiency doing stuff with Mac, but there's some great programs for Windows too. I mean, I know one of the first programs, even before I got into Reason and Ableton, was Fruity Loops. I used that on Windows, and you know, that worked. I mean, you can't do quite as much, but it's just amazing what you can do out there now, you know. And it's funny, Jeremy Soule, I don't know if you know who that is, he's a composer. He does a lot of soundtrack, particularly game music. And I had messaged him, he had posted one of his most recent works on Facebook, and I was like, wow, this is really beautiful, I like this. And I asked him if he used, like, I use Native Instruments Contact. It's a sound synthesizer, and you can get different packs. And I mean, these packs, some of these sound packs run like $1,000 if you, purchase them retail.
It samples from actual instruments in different parts of their scale, and you put them together and you...
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 96K and really high quality. But anyway, I asked him if he, like, there was one Symphobia and Lumina, which is specifically for scores, and I asked him if he'd ever use those. He's like, no, I hate using those prepackaged computer programs. I was like, all right, man, cool.
Okay. But he's a pro. He's a pro anyway. Yeah. We've come a long time. I'm a big Queen fan. I remember for the first probably five albums, they would proudly write a phrase on the albums, and they would say no synths, which was you know, interesting at the time, because if you heard a harpsichord, that would be an actual harpsichord. And
It's pretty revolutionary to not use the synths.
Well, at that time, that was probably 70 something, and still synths were pretty new, but they were all in vogue. I remember Frank Zappa made an album that was a bunch of old scores by a composer, Francesco Zappa. Francesco Zappa was—he was an actual composer. I think he was a Baroque composer. And
wasn't it called Zappa Does Zappa? I think.
I don't know. I think like it was actually Francesco Zappa was the name of the album, and there was it was like some fox character. The in the cover was some fox character dressed up as someone from the 16th century. And I love that album, because it was Baroque compositions, but all played with the first synthesizer there was at the time in this late 60s. It was called it's not coming to mind, but it will come to mind.
I know, it's on the tip of my tongue.
The Synclavier. The Synclavier, which was, you know, you had to know electronics to play it.
Yep.
Ooh. So, playing the music of liberty. Should we go to the market, Chandler?
Yes, let's go to the market. Let's get some music.
We'll be right back. Should get some music.
Worms.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. but they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
So, I think we need to do a little fiend sourcing. During the break, I was asking you there, and if any of you fiends out there have any idea what I'm talking about, please message me on Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus or whatever. There was a Japanese artist, and it was in the mid-70s to late-70s. I don't know how long he was out, but I remember my stepfather had these actual vinyl albums, and this guy did all kinds of weird synth music, like new-agey digital stuff, and I can't for the life of me remember his name, and my stepfather's passed away now, so I don't know, and I don't know where the albums are. And I'd love to find it, you know, see if I could find it online. I'm sure it's been released on, you know, CD or iTunes or something, but I can't remember this guy's name. So if any of you guys out there have any idea who this might be, shoot me a message, because I'd love to find it.
Let Chandler know, yeah. And, you know, Japanese music sometimes really, really weird for us Westerners. And, well, in electronic music and jazz, once I remember I was listening to a Japanese jazz album, and it all sounded like video game music from the 80s, which I really love. So, yeah, the music of the that old game Contra.
Yep.
Did you ever play that game on the NES?
All the time.
All the time. And it was really... That was really nice music. And, well, there are people who are fans. I have an acquaintance here in Mexico. He studied with me in college and doing computer engineering. And he's a huge video game fan. And he does our arcade reconstruction and building and all those things. And he has a podcast that's just about video game music, which is just amazing.
You're going to have to send me a link to that. I'd love that. You know, one of my favorite composers is, and I forgive me if I pronounce it wrong, but Nobuo Uematsu, I believe. He did a lot of the music for the Final Fantasy games, and he's done some other stuff, video games. But he is amazing. Some of the Final Fantasy suites, their symphonic suites, you know, and it's classical music, basically. Some of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard. He is great. I have just, you know, like a hard drive full of that type of music, because, like I said, I really like musical scores, and he's really one of the top ones, in my opinion.
And we're not encouraging, we do not condone tiger moms, you know, forcing their children to play the piano when they're four.
Yes.
But still, if it happens and they turn out to be music geniuses, I think...
You know, that's probably my one regret in life. My dad always tried to encourage me to play the piano, and it's like, nah, I don't want to do that. This is lame. And now, I wish I'd... I actually self-taught myself how to play Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven.
Yeah,
and well, I couldn't get through the whole song, but I could play the first chord of it, a couple of chords anyway. But I do. I love piano music, and I so wish I would have gotten into that at an early age and stuck with it.
So you'd have loved to have a tiger dad.
Yep, yep. I sure would have.
Chandler, go play. Go do your obligatory hour on the piano.
Yep.
Yeah, but you know, people get really good in the instruments they play for fun, and that's. I listened to a story by Brian May, the guitar player of Queen, once that he said, you know, I can play the piano, but it was a chore. I had to do it every day for an hour. Whereas I went to the guitar for fun, always. And so my guitar playing improved much faster.
Well, I think as long as you have a passion for learning and creating that art, you'll excel. I mean, one of my favorite guitarists, and I think he's one of the best out there, Zach Wilde, you know, he talked about how he wanted to be a rock star, right? but he knew that that just doesn't happen. And he used to sit there for 2 hours a day and just practice chords on the guitar till he could get it right. You know, now he's living his dream.
Yeah, and I think modern life will let people live their musical dreams even if they don't become rock stars, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you can have a job on the side.
Yeah.
And be
do
playing
it for fun. And who knows, maybe someday you'll make some money off it. But at least you'll be happy.
Yeah, at least one or two people will listen to you in iTunes and you'll be able to do what you love. Like the Fiends. We do radio for love, right?
We do. Well, hey, man, it was good talking to you. It
was good talking to you and to everybody out there. You know, live free and have fun. Live like the stage is gone.
Take care, everyone.
Word.